Well, this evening, friends, we're in a fair way to be in trouble, because we have to make a series of comparisons which may be very confusing, and if a general confusion results, we will be in a completely scientific attitude, because that is exactly the way the matter is. We now come to somewhat of a parting of the ways between what we may term materialistic knowledge and the esoteric teaching of ancient peoples. We want to be a little careful, however, in evaluating not only this division or separation of concepts, but attempt to determine, if possible, whether this is really a division or whether it is an impact upon prejudiced viewpoints which makes reconciliation difficult without adequate thoughtfulness. This evening we have to deal with the problem of the rise and development of races. We are already in trouble when we actually announce the subject. For this reason, we seldom, if ever, pause to wonder how the anthropologist uses the term race in the processes of his classification and investigation. First of all, he clearly tells us that the words that he uses to represent racial differentiation are completely arbitrary. They are signs and symbols by means of which others of similar minds may discover what he is attempting to convey. The term race today has probably only one basic meaning, and that is the human race. About this, there seems to be no general difference of opinion. From this point on, everything becomes less certain. Actually, philosophy, religion, ancient concepts of culture assume the existence of a primordial humanity, a humanity as yet undifferentiated into the racial divisions that we commonly refer to. This total humanity forms a kind of archetypal or collective being, the anthropos. The total selfness of humanity. Where this can be placed in chronology or in geographical location has not been firmly resolved. Perhaps the only geographical area large enough to contain the concept of race is the earth itself. For race transcends all boundaries of continents and areas. Perhaps the only time, chronological sequence, large enough to envelop this subject adequately, is simply all time, which has elapsed since the development of a human species in nature. Thus, what we term race today should convey something of the total concept of human beings. It should remind us that humanity is a kind in nature, that it is ultimately a total kind. Actually, from the standpoint of genetics, there is less than 1% variance among all human beings. Thus, what we term variety or variance arises not in the phenomenon of nature, but in the cultural experience of man himself. Allowing, therefore, that there is a collective mankind, we can then follow the Pythagorean concept. The division never divides a collective. The division always exists within a collective. Therefore, various divisions can arise within humanity, but this does not mean that humanity is divided. It means that in 99% of the essentials of our nature, we are always one creature. And that this 1% becomes overly important to us, largely because of our interpretations and our addiction to things seen rather than to things known, factually or philosophically. There is much to assume, therefore, at the beginning of our experience in person, that there was a common race. There is also much to tell us that this common race is no longer visible to us. It has ceased to be visible because it has been submerged, as far as its appearances are concerned, in the divisions which have arisen within it. This does not mean that this primordial race ceased. Rather, that this primordial race continues as the pure substance of race, and that from and within this substance, an infinite diversification takes place. The ancient Aryan Hindus tell us that there was an ancient race, a race that preceded all known races, but this race vanished in the dawn of things. But this race was composed of beings that were to disappear into the life ways of their own descendants, or those that descended from them in terms of racial differentiation. That there must have been a hypothetical first race, we must assume. There has to be a first of anything that has a beginning. But instead of imagining that this first is an individual or a group of individuals, the ancient Hindu scholars assumed that this first was the total stuff. That this first was a kind of vast architect's plan, a living plan, incorporated into substances, developing according to an almost incredible span of time and an almost infinite diversification. Thus, the first race never died, because there can be, and never has been, but one race. This race, however, passes from our recognition, passes from our phenomenal contact, because it is disappearing constantly into the structure of the races which are produced from it. This concept is not actually in variance with basic anthropological thinking. It may represent, however, an angle or approach to the subject which has not been given as much consideration as certain other subjects. I would say that the anthropologist today is more interested in discovering a unity than in realizing that it has always existed. Of course, he is unconsciously and instinctively admitting its existence, or he would not be able to search for it or believe that he could find it. Now, the next point that we have to bear in mind in this consideration is that in modern terms, in the terms of living people, anthropology deals only with things as they are now. It may attempt to extend certain of its reflections into causes. Causes rather of how than of why. It may also seek to extend itself into the future to make its utilitarian contribution to the progress of culture. But essentially, the anthropologist, and for that matter, all of us, think in terms of the immediate. Therefore, our concept of man is our concept of man as he is now distributed about the earth, with the division, social, religious, cultural, racial, that we now recognize. Yet in arriving at such terms as we presently use, we should bear in mind the fact that these terms are geared only to the contemporary, and the anthropologist is the first person to admit this. He realizes that he is about all pride. He is talking about only those familiar parts of pride which are within his present examination. And he is using things as they are as a kind of symbol by means of which he hopes to clarify his primary end, namely, cultural enlightenment on the subject of man, not of any particular man or group of men, but of man as a collective. If we assume for a moment that which he will have trouble in denying, that there was a common humanity. This common humanity is a kind of being, a person, growing up very much as the human body develops. For within this human body of ours, there are an infinite number of parts. These parts down to the smallest division, cellular structure, are still essential to the total concept of the human body. Therefore, the total body human of society is an entity or a unity composed of an infinite diversity of parts. Anthropology is concerned to a degree to determine, if possible, the basic reason for this diversity. Actually, he hasn't done too well, and he is among the first to realize that he has not done too well. It is hard for him to do as he would like to do, for the simple reason that the evidence necessary has been obliterated in the aeons of time that have already passed over, and about which we have no adequate record. Man began as a non-recording creature. Therefore, up to the time of the discovery of a method or means for the transmission of knowledge, we have no adequate continuity of account concerning man. We do have, as has been mentioned previously, two possible streams of evidence. One, tradition, legend, myth, lore, which have descended as part of the cultural heritage of mankind. The other is man's internal repository of intuition, of instinct, of the power to dream or to visualize. And modern psychology is beginning to recognize the re-emergence of the archaic or the ancient through the symbolic processes of human thinking. Thus, man has the whole story of his kind locked within himself. And this story of his kind, he lives out every day of his existence. And the primary impulses and instincts which move him today derive from the primary instincts and impulses which primordially moved his kind. And we find these impulses now rather dramatically and grammatically expressed for us in terms of security, peace, fellowship, friendship, integrity, honor. And these subtle processes which arise within the individual. We must not, however, ever confuse the impulse of honor, for example, with the concept of the honorable. They are two entirely distinct things. The honorable expresses itself through innumerable codes which may be proper to one people and improper to another. But the instinct to attain to certain levels of accepted conduct must be regarded as basic. At the same time that we proceed with this line of thinking, it is interesting to pause and consider something else, because there is no doubt in the world that the study of languages parallels very closely the study of mankind. In the first place, at some very remote time, man became vocally articulate. How he became so is again uncertain. Perhaps we have some key to it in the mimicry of certain birds and animals that copy other sounds and do so originally and primarily for purposes of survival, although this has no longer its original importance. that man began by communicating ideas by sounds originally associated with those ideas, perhaps is our most natural conclusion. Therefore, when man instinctively wept because of sadness, he made certain sounds, and he was later able to copy those sounds to express sadness, even though at the moment he was not weeping. He might, in one way or another, also associate sounds with activity, with places, and with various procedures in living. But in the course of time, there arose in the primordial human group a primordial human language. This human language, like the group itself, has disappeared. Perhaps it has something to do with the ancient pre-Sanskrit language of India, sometimes referred to as Sansa, or the language of the gods. Very often, we create mythological concepts to express this problem. But we are in now one very simple position, that in language as in race, we begin with an archetype. We begin with a total language. And what we know as languages arise from the total language. There were certain common words, words that arose in the prehistory of man. And out of these, there came into existence an extremely flexible vocabulary, long before man had any written form whatsoever. Some may wonder just to what degree this vocabulary was universal. I think we probably will find that it was universal in its beginning, and like all other things in nature, drifts from a universal to a particular condition. In all probability, these primordial sounds, like certain primordial ideas which are distributed throughout mankind, arose from such simple natural phenomena that most peoples either held them in common or were able to recognize them when others made use of them. That this language should die, disappear, vanish from the face of the earth, is not reasonable or proper, any more than that the first race of men should vanish from the earth. What happened was that this language became submerged. It was submerged within and behind languages, so that we cannot actually say with certainty that any language spoken by man today was first, although almost all ancient cultures claim a certain priority for their own. Actually, the first language has disappeared into all others, just as the first race has vanished into all others. The proof of this, of course, lies in the most ancient and basic terms and words that we know. In old days, men made a great study of comparative words, and where they found the easiest and most available supply of these words was in religion. They found especially in the great ancient Sargic documents, in the great epics of their people, in their great scriptural writings, in their myths and legends, and possibly most essentially in the names of their deities, one very common source or common ground. Another very common and natural ground, as we might suspect, was the name of foods, various food elements. The names for most common and simple things, most anciently known, were the words that still survive, hidden in the extensive vocabularies that have later developed. We think it is interesting to find, for instance, the name of a Greek deity, traceable in India, or the name of an Egyptian god, paralleled in America. We begin to think that the possibility is of migrations that account for this. Perhaps to a measure they do on a secondary level of later events. But primarily, these words are kind of root words from mother languages. They have passed through various modifications, which the students of this subject can handle. But actually, we have evidence of a common spoken language. A language which may have been inadequate to the specialization of people, so that it vanished from our notice as specialization proceeded. and particular and special things required more and more attention. But in this specialization, attention being constantly turned to the new, the old was left pretty much alone. Therefore, it is in the oldest and most basic words that the common language is most easily traced, although we cannot hope to restore it entirely. We know it was there, just as there was a common humanity that undoubtedly made use of it in the dawn of things. This common language was extinct, or at least submerged to the point where it was no longer noticeable, before the invention of writing. And also, we are possessed of very little knowledge of its sound, because no man has ever heard it. It was not spoken in historic times. And even had it been, we would not be able to be certain that it has descended to us. We have tried for many years to restore the Pythagorean lute, but we cannot do so because no one has ever heard it. The living person has not heard it, so he does not know arbitrarily what its sounds might be. We can follow the formulas used by such records as we know and attempt to reconstruct it, but we can never be certain that the tones we form are identical with those that Pythagoras created. We have no way of knowing because we cannot hear those sounds. Thus, so many things are dim and dark to us because we can no longer participate in them. But we have to consider them merely as hypothetical reconstructions. And this is the situation we are in, a very large part of our cultural problem. Also, we know human habits are rather interesting things. And today, for instance, when we speak of ancient people, we never, or practically never, speak in mind of anthropology or biological situation. When we say the ancient Greeks, we never begin in our mind to measure stones or anything of that nature, because the ancient Greek to us is a cultural entity, not a racial entity. A Greek is someone in a toga who said certain things, did certain things. He was an artist, a scholar, a mathematician, a philosopher, a warrior. When we think back upon ancient Greece, there is nothing less important to us than the biological aspects of Grecian life. We have no interest in it. When we think of the Romans, we are not attempting to determine the difference between a Roman and a Syrian. We are not at all concerned. To us, a Roman is a soldier, a legislator, an emperor, a despot, perhaps, an adventurer, a conqueror. But he is not a biological entity. And the same is true today in viewing practically all cultures that we know, except for a small group of specialists who are searching constantly for missing links in the descent of man. All peoples are now divided according to their cultures, recognized and admired according to their cultures, or reproved because of the defects of their cultures. We no longer think of them in terms of their genes, but in terms of their genius, and it's just as well, probably. On this basis also, we must recognize that essentially the development of race is marked by the development of culture. Development has no essential meaning to us except in terms of culture. We think of the physical structure as underlying culture. If the Greeks hadn't lived, if he hadn't had arms and legs, he would not have been able to be a scholar, a philosopher, or an artist. We assume his biological capacity for the things which he achieved. But we make little moment of it and pass on immediately to matters of some greater concern. It is the same of individuals. We are quite certain that Plato was weaned at one time, but no one cares. No one is at all concerned with the fact that Plato probably passed through the childhood diseases and may have been a slight problem to his relatives in his infancy. These things mean nothing. We are interested totally and solely in the man as a cultural unit and the effect which he had upon his own time and upon all time subsequent. It is the same in the study of humanity. The infancy of man, with its innumerable problems, is really of very little interest to us. What we are trying to discover constantly is not the story of man's biological growth, but the record of man's achievement, as this achievement affected his own time and affects our time. Thus, under certain covers, we sometimes misrepresent our own point of view, and we make another very serious mistake when we attempt to bind culture to biology. In other words, if we should go so far as to say that a Greek attained his culture merely because of his biological existence, we would be getting ourselves into a serious situation. When the Greek becomes a symbol of culture, as it has so become, it is a symbol of an attainment, not of a biological situation. So we have to watch carefully that we do not assume that certain racial problems must inevitably be involved deeply in cultural problems. In our modern researches, we know that this fallacy can lead to the gravest misunderstandings and miscomprehensions in general. The next point that perhaps we should attempt to consider is what we know as the account of the descent of races. Today, we have established what might be called a tripod. Humanity following, perhaps, the ancient doctrines of revelation. The human family, in our present experience, not considering at the moment such races and such experiences as have passed so long in limbo that we cannot even reconstruct them, we seem to find a trinity arising within the racial structure of man, just as it arose in his religion and philosophy. This trinity presents us with a threefold enclosure, which is valuable only because it represents the extreme boundaries of something. It does not tell us anything particularly about the contents, but it does bound an area and give us a certain point upon which to work. Therefore, we consider the variable of mankind as contained within a triangular frame consisting of three basic types of humanity, recognized as surviving now, and also recognized as having descended from a very great antiquity. These are the three races with which we today seek to identify all human beings, namely the Caucasoid or Caucasian, the Mongoloid or Mongolian, and the Negroid or Negro. We regard these not as telling us anything, except that they form a framework. And if you extend a human type in any direction to its ultimate, as far as we can do under existing conditions, we cannot extend it beyond the framework of these three basic demarcations. We cannot find anything outside of them. But we do not have quite as easy a time when we begin to look inside of the wall. The wall is convenient. It is comparatively meaningless. Yet it does help us to a certain degree. Now, because of the fact that we have only a very limited time, we cannot go into all the ramifications of this subject, but let us give a symbolic example of exactly what we mean when we say that these boundaries are exceedingly abstract and elusive. Let us take a race with which we have considerable, immediate, and continuous contact. The Caucasoid or Caucasian race. Now, what are we dealing with? Well, the first thing that most people will say is, well, we're now dealing with the white race. That's the first mistake. We are not. Well, we like to think that perhaps we are, however, but what does the word Caucasoid actually mean on the level of our interest? It means nothing more or less than a native of the Caucasus. Now, the Caucasus is an area. Now, it's very unlikely that most Caucasians of today have ever been there. But it represents, to the anthropologist, the seat of a type. To his thinking, the people of the Caucasus represent an almost perfect specimen of a kind of people. And he calls these people, therefore, Caucasians. Now, exactly where do the Caucasians live? And here we come into an interesting problem. We discover that the Caucasians inhabit Europe, North Africa, and Asia Minor. Now, we might assume that they live in Brooklyn or Chicago, but when we move them into North Africa or into Asia Minor, we begin to have a little trouble with them because they are no longer the kind of people that we assume to be Caucasian. Yet they are. Because the Caucasian represents a whole series of factors. Essentially, these factors are determined by scales and by the development of certain basic cranial and other measurements by which we determine, not from appearance, but from structure, the basic family to which a people may belong. Now, if we check systematically into the subject, we will find, for example, an Arab. Now, this Arab may be almost any color you can think of, from a very pale olive shade, resembling somewhat a citizen of Sicily, or he may be practically negroid, as far as the color of his skin is concerned. But you will always be able to distinguish him by the structure of his body and face and head. You will also be able to distinguish the way his hair grows and a number of interesting developments. One is nose, by which he can never be mistaken for anything but what he is. And yet, as far as his clothing is concerned, his language is concerned, he certainly is not an immediate example of kinship with some gentleman in one of the English social sets. He is not the same, but he is the same. Therefore, you look him up and you find that the Arab is a Caucasoid. He belongs to the same stock that produced the Greek, the Roman, the late Persian, the Irishman, the Teuton, and the American. Now, we say the American because he is gradually coming into an identity. He is an example of something we're going to mention a little later, namely the noble polyglot. Now, among other interesting examples of the Caucasian is, in all probability, your Phoenician, your Chaldean, your Babylonian. These ancient gentlemen with long beards and high crowns that 3,000, 4,000, 5,000 years ago reigned from their empires in the valley of the Euphrates. These were good Caucasians. Yet time and consideration divides us very greatly from them. You look up in any work on anthropology the word Semite, and you will learn that it is a branch of the Caucasian race, something we have not ever thought about. Why? Because regardless of what this man believes, regardless of his cultural background as we know them, regardless of any other factor, he is bound into a pattern by genes and by the basic structure of his nature. So that we have, under the word Caucasian, a marvelous differentiation of possibilities. Now, the same is equally true of the Negroid type. The Negroid type we essentially regard as the basic type of the African people. However, he also extends into some rather remote and unexpected areas, showing up with a variety of attributes. But never can we mistake the basic structure of this particular group. A Mongolian is another. Now, a Mongolian is a very polyglot group. And he has had a tremendous influence. Actually, we know today that the Mongolian group is larger than both the Caucasian and the Negroid put together, and also shows up in more places than even the Caucasian, regarding him as a trader, adventurer, and explorer. Actually, your Mongolian or Mongoloid is the most widely diffused and distributed of all your groups. Now, the moment we come to the realization of this, we come into another situation, which has been very well pointed out by anthropology. Namely, that at this time in our racial development of life, there is practically no possibility of differentiating either the racial or cultural descent of any people. This is, therefore, one of the points that we must hold against all arbitrary division. The division is diagrammatic. It is not factual in experience. Actually, the human race, as is said today, is none of these things, essentially. It is actually a kind of mongrel, which has in it all of these elements. Now, how did all these elements get there? First, to tremendous extent in time, and also due to the fact that in this course of time, all of these different groups, at one date or another, had a place in the sun. They did not always maintain this place in the sun, but every one of these basic groups was at one time or another dominant. And as a result of this dominance, gained enormous spheres of influence, and to a measure imposed their cultures upon other people. Now, wherever we have a dominant group, we find that dominant group extending not only culturally but racially into the bloodstream of subdominant groups. It always and inevitably occurs. Therefore, at an ancient and remote time, we find the Mongolians becoming a very powerful and dominant group. In more recent times, we have further evidence of the same thing at the time of the great campaigns of Genghis Khan and Kublai Khan. During the campaigns of Genghis Khan, the Mongolian reached the boundaries of Europe and broke through in a number of areas. And as a result of this breakthrough, he is very strong racially among most of the Slavonic peoples and even as far as the Germanic. And there are a great many Germanic families that have Mongolian blood. Another important point of breakthrough in more ancient times affecting the relationship between the Caucasian and the Negroid was the rise of the Ethiopian dynasties in Egypt. During these dynastic periods, the Ethiopian kings ruled the world. As a result of that, they were not people of lesser estate. They were not regarded as in any regard inferior. During this time, they filtrated throughout what we call most of the Caucasian area. And they certainly played a tremendous part in the rise of all cultures that were affected by the later Egyptian culture. These things are merely examples of a general trend. Now let us take a little different type of situation. We have in the Pacific a very interesting and intriguing group of people we call the Japanese. Now, from the standpoint of anthropology, they are a little bit of a mystery also, because we have to recognize at least four levels of Japanese racial differentiation. The first is the X-race, the original inhabitants of the island. And as most cases, the X-race doesn't count very much. It more or less disappears. It is either submerged into, or in one way or another, disposed of by the rising tide of other racial motions. The second group that is still comparatively powerful in the Japanese area and contributed to the molding of what we call the modern Japanese was the Korean-Manchurian racial division of the Mongolians. They contributed considerably to a certain type
of Japanese that tend to be, I think, dominant of this characteristic.
In addition to the Korean Manchurian, there was a direct motion from the purely Chinese Mongolian into this area, which is marked by another differentiation, also in this case, essentially Mongolian. The third group comes from an entirely different basic culture order and is called, usually, the Malaysian-Indonesian culture, which represents, in many instances, a small, slight body, and the tremendous agility and grace and many of the psychological structures of these peoples, including the native faith, as it is called in Japan, Shintoism, which is strongly influenced by Indonesian and Malaysian culture. These people represent, in turn, a polyglot involving other factors, going back and back and back. So we now have a people that represents a coming together and combination of at least three racial and three major cultural trends imposed upon a primitive group. Now, in your Indian situation, your East Indian situation, your anthropology is also rather complicated. There was an X factor or a basic people in India at a very remote time, we call the Dravidians. The Dravidians were apparently the natural occupants of the great area which we now call the Indo-Gangetic Plain. These people were a comparatively simple group whose cultural program we will also have to consider because there is a major difference between simplicity and inferiority, and we have got to clear that up somewhere along the line. And that, again, is not an easy one. But with the coming of the Arya Hindu, Arya meaning the lords or the rulers or the anointed or the destined ones, we find the gradual submergence of Dravidian culture. Where then do we find that Dravidian culture in the Hindu culture? We find it at the bottom or at the innermost part. And yet, from this primitive source, brings perhaps some of the most powerful influences in the forming of later Hindu and Indic life, as for example, the tremendous binding tie between the Aryan and the Dravidian as found in the Rig Veda, which is the oldest of the great books of Indian law. Now, where the Aryans came from is again a matter of cultural problem, and here's one that we can't solve in terms of anthropology, because we can't come to any common ground with them. Actually, according to the Eastern sages, and these are the people involved, the Aryas came down originally from the Trans-Himalayas, or that area of India which lies south of the great Siberian stretch and north of the common country of India as we know it, in the area now largely the region of the Himalaya Mountains. The high plateaus of these mountains are said to have originally been the home of a people, which because of the very environment in which they lived and because of the tremendous racial pressures within them, were a far more active people than those living south in a more tropical climate, and gradually, in extending their power downward, they conquered or dominated the entire area and finally forced the Dravidians either to accept them or to run before them, which some did, and took their final refuge on the island of Ceylon. All this tremendous picture represents drives of ancient people. Whether this occurred, as the East Indian believes, perhaps a million years ago, or whether it occurred 50 or 100,000 years ago, the legend, the lore, the tradition seems to make certain that it did occur or exist. But if we go back now to our anthropological viewpoint, and of course, let's face it, we can't reconcile. Because if you look up Aryan in modern anthropology, you will gain an answer that you might not expect at all. Namely, that the Aryan is one of the divisions of the Caucasian race. Now, the reason for this standpoint apparently is that the anthropologist does recognize that the Aryans is the same bloodstream as the Anglo-Saxon. But although he is on the opposite side of the world, that he wears a turban, he is still one of us. Something that we sometimes fail to remember, and perhaps we can be excused for a brief detour because of an interesting thing that happened some years ago in this country, which has a bearing upon general ignorance of anthropology. And that is that when the Maharaja Gaikwad of Baroda, one of the greatest of the Indian princes, came to this country to attend the World Fellowship of Faith during the time of the last great Chicago Exposition, he engaged a complete floor in a prominent hotel. The hotel refused to put him up because he was not a Caucasian. And as a result of that, and in order that he might not be further embarrassed, he bought the hotel. Now this... and because he was a Caucasian, he sold it a few weeks later at a profit. So you can have your own viewpoint on these matters. But the fact remains that while anthropology has the attitude that the Aryan moved from the Caucasus into Asia, the Hindu has the attitude that the Aryan moved down from the north. Whereas the old Persian culture would have a tendency, I think, to suspect that what we call this grand motion actually began in the general area of the Near East. So that Persian culture would probably come a little nearer to agreeing with modern anthropology than would be more ancient Hindu culture. But here, out of this, we have only been doing all these ramblings for one essential purpose, namely to point out that nearly all of the boundaries which we have set up, by which we can arbitrarily distinguish between people, these boundaries are boundaries of words. They are also boundaries of ideas not thought through or not enlightened by available general information. They represent, therefore, to some degree, a limitation of perspective. And with this recognition, the anthropologist of today is ever less willing to commit himself on any of these subjects. He is afraid of words for the reason that nearly all these words have become semantically unsound, and therefore fail to convey the principles which he wishes to convey. Actually, it is relatively impossible to differentiate today any culture and associate it exclusively with a race. Culture is far more democratic than structure, and it has cut through structure on almost every front where development has taken place. Well, as we have identified the possibility of one race gradually individualizing within itself, according to certain great universal laws, a triad of basic racial processes, we may also assume, without any particular danger of being inaccurate or unscientific, one basic language, breaking gradually into a triad of basic languages which begin to emerge. And finally, one basic culture which gradually breaks up into a triad of culture groups, so that this entire process begins and develops upon a 1-3 formula. And this formula is to be traced and is traceable in almost every part of our cultural world. So now we want to pass for a moment to the cultural phase of this emergence of racial groups and things of that nature. And the next problem then that comes to us is the effort to determine relative advance in culture. Because essentially, we think of evolution as evolution in culture. We do not think of it as evolution in race. One reason being that evolution or change in culture is within historic records. Therefore, we may observe at least historic records. Whereas evolution in race is so vast and incredible a procedure that any amount of it that we can bring within comprehension is too small a fragment to be representative of any certain indication. In order to have any concept of evolution and race, clear concept, we would have to be able to examine the clear and certain records of at least a half a million or a million years. This we cannot do. But we observe that cultures move more rapidly. Therefore, we are able to do more with them. And we must not be deceived by what we consider to be surviving aboriginal racial groups. Aboriginal groups as we know them today are far removed from the original, even though we are inclined to compare them with other groups and doubt their superiority, or at least doubt their ability to survive adequately in the general culture of prevailing times. So what is the basis by which we shall determine culture? Now, culture, I do not necessarily mean refinement. We speak of persons of culture. This is not the usage which I wish to make of it. I wish to use it in the terms of the cultural pattern by which people live. Those who attain harmonious adjustment with their cultural pattern are termed culture. But the pattern is far more ancient and more basic. There is no doubt in the world that the basic cultural pattern, which like the basic language and the basic race, has been submerged, still lies at the root of all culture groups and forms the beginning, the seed, from which all the differentiated cultures of man arise. These cultures are therefore variations upon a theme, and the theme itself remains essentially unchanged. In determining culture, then, we have also another problem, namely the effort to determine the status of the individual by his culture and the status of the culture by the individual. Therefore, we like to say a primitive individual and a primitive culture. And we would feel in a very unhappy situation if we found a truly primitive individual who did not have a primitive culture, but had some other kind. This would be considered an anomaly and would be hard to understand. Dr. Margaret Mead, who has been one of the most interesting and prominent of modern anthropologists, has come to a number of very interesting findings on the subject of basic culture. The difference between simplicity and ignorance. The difference between basic culture and unfolded culture. Also, the essential difference between culture and decadence. And these things are terribly important in determining the growth and development of the human race. We realize in some mysterious way that life is a motion from childhood or childishness through maturity and on again to childlikeness. We have an essential instinctive realization that value is simple. And it is that which is not valuable that is complex. On that basis, we have to approach the simple person with a little different attitude from that with which we are commonly aware. The first point is that true knowledge is actually the knowledge of what to do now. This becomes a tremendously essential factor in knowledge. Another form or phase of knowledge is that it is the ability, the intellectual resource necessary to fulfill the purpose for living. Outside of this essential pattern of knowledge, there is a great deal of exaggerated knowledge, much of which is essential foolishness in disguise. So our anthropologists, attempting to determine value, must determine the difference between learned and unlearned foolishness, and also learned and unlearned wisdom. Because culture is essential value, not assumed value. And an anthropologist would say definitely that the fact that man makes a satellite to go around the moon around the earth, has nothing to do with culture, and does not advance him culturally one iota. But when man ends juvenile delinquency, he has made a major step forward in culture. That an individual is rich has nothing to do with culture. The fact that that individual has a harmonious home in which there is no argument or infidelity, that is culture. That an individual shall be successful, advancing his own purposes, has nothing to do with culture. The degree to which he is unselfish for the common good is culture. Now, these are the differences. Therefore, it is quite possible for a Hottentot to be on a high platform of culture and a highly educated so-called Caucasian on a low level of culture. How are we going to determine culture? Now, you can argue this point for a long while and come up with a variety of solutions. Dr. Mead, in her researches among a group of people in the island of New Guinea, a little isolated group of about 1,500 families, discovered that these primitive people had, as part of their essential cultural platform, a very simple fact, namely, that in the family, the general tendency has been to forget the father, to make him independent too soon of responsibility for the child. So according to their philosophy of life, the father is held equally responsible for the development of the child before and after birth and must perform constant ritual until the child is 5 years old in order that this child shall have a proper maturity. As a result of that, the father works as hard as the mother, psychologically and religiously, through prayer, through fasting, through service, through keeping an equal watchfulness with the mother, taking every possible part in the life of that child, washing it, dressing it, doing everything that the mother does for 5 years, in order that that father shall always have the realization that he played a great part in the life of that child. The result is, they have a certain problem in their social system which they have solved and we have not. Namely, the recognition of the importance of both parents and absolutely no competition. No competition in the home, says the old priest of that tribe, means no crime among the children. Now, what shall we say about his culture platform? Shall we say that we can compare that with a sniff to the graduate of Oxford or Cambridge? What is culture? That is the question the anthropologist must answer, and it's not nearly as easy as you think. It finally leads him to the inevitable conclusion that culture is non-comparative. That you cannot compare culture. You can only compare deficiency of culture. You can only say that the individual who lives well has more culture than the individual who does not live well. That the individual who is innately honest is higher on the level of culture than the individual who is not. We may say that a more complicated civilization makes the practice of primitive virtues increasingly difficult. The anthropologists will say yes, but it also makes available greater and greater knowledge, by means of which we should be able to compensate for this difference. Therefore, essential culture rises from a series of factors, and these factors are perhaps as vital and even more important than racial division in determining the proper classification of mankind.